Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. We're also at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to the co-directors of the film The Sun Behind the Clouds, Tibet's Struggle for Freedom. I'm very happy now to welcome Garth Clark. He is a historian and writer on contemporary and modern ceramics. He's an art dealer. Cody Sanderson is with us. He's a contemporary Native American jeweler. And Peter Stessel is the director of the Blue Rain Gallery in Santa Fe. And they are all here to talk about the SOFA West exhibition, which is coming up at the Santa Fe Convention Center this coming, July 8th through 11th. This coming week at the Santa Fe Convention Center. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's hear a little bit about SOFA. It stands for Sculpture, Objects, and Functional Art, and it's a huge event. You've been working with it, Garth, for a long time.
Yeah, we started with them in the early 1980s when it was called SANAFI. It was in Chicago. Then they expanded to New York, and as of last year, to Santa Fe as well. And it showcases contemporary craft and applied arts, and very lively exhibition.
And so people can see everything from jewelry to furniture, is that correct?
That's correct.
So the sofa has a little bit of a double meaning.
It has a bit of a double meaning. Maybe they should have called it chaise.
Would have been a little harder maybe to come up with an acronym for whatever that stands for. You have devoted many, many years, decades of your life to the study of ceramics.
That's true.
How did you start in that whole path?
I married a potter. Isn't that a good shortcut? But I really also had been collecting Art Deco ceramics before that, and it goes right back to when I was living in South Africa. And then, because I was a journalist, I found that there was very little writing of any quality on the field. And that drew me in, and 50 books later, I'm still absolutely fascinated with the field.
The fact of there being no really high-quality books, what's that all about? Do art historians think of it as a craft and sort of a second-class citizen, or what's going on with that?
Well, they did. That's more a historical statement than, you know, one that is true today. The publishing has developed tremendously. The critical aspects of ceramics have grown also. And in fact, there's going to be a huge conference in Santa Fe in October on ceramics and criticism.
Ah, maybe we will talk to some people at that time.
It's going to be fun.
So when you write about ceramics, what points of view do you take? Do you write about the artist? Do you write about the crafts, about their place in cultural history?
Well, you write about it in the same way as you write about other visual art, and elements of biography become important sometimes, but more so I'm interested in the formal elements of it, the aesthetic elements, the what an object says rather than how it is made.
When people, I mean, you are an art dealer as well, so when people are buying ceramics, where are they coming from? Are they coming from wanting functional objects in their house, or do they buy them the way they would buy other works of art as collectors?
Our clients, and it's not true of every gallery, but our clients really come from the contemporary art world in the main. So they are buying something, a vase or whatever, which is also an art object. To have in their home, but we don't deal much in functional work. The functional aspects of the ceramics that we handle have more of a conceptual basis than one in reality.
What does that look like? Some examples.
Well, it can be anything. It can be a pot. It can be a figurative sculpture. There's a tremendous breadth to what is done in ceramics. I think the issue becomes most interesting when you are dealing with a vase form, because in some people's minds they can't see beyond the function of the piece, to put water in it and flowers. But, you know, there are some major, major artists who work with that as a format. Grayson Perry is one. Recently he was given the award from the Tate. It's called the Turner Prize. It's one of the major awards in the entire art world, and he makes pots. So when he got it, he stood up He also happens to be a cross-dresser, so he stood up in his frock to accept his award, and he said, I don't know what's going to upset you most about me getting this award, the fact that I make pots or that I wear frocks. And he said, I think it's probably the former, hinting at the fact that there is still a little bit of a divide in the art world about how they see ceramics, but it's changing so quickly now.
How are techniques in ceramics changing? Obviously, we have traditional pottery going back thousands of years here in the Southwest and so on, but what kind of scientific and technical advancements have been made?
There have been some extraordinary advancements. They have created ceramics that is actually flexible. They have created engine blocks out of ceramics, scalpels for surgery, but that's all in the realm of science. The use of ceramics in the art world still hasn't changed very much. It's still using pretty much the basic elements. You can add a few extra things like laser cutting of shapes in ceramics and the rest of it, but it's not about the technique. It's about what you say with the work.
And so in the upcoming SOFA West exhibit, what are some of the most exciting pieces and types of work that people are going to be able to see?
Well, we have two native artists on the show, but we're not native specialists. We work with them because they are really contemporary ceramists and they fit as easily into the American mainstream of contemporary art as they are identified with Santa Fe itself, and that is Christine McHorse, who does very, very interesting abstract form, and Diego Romero, who is a wicked satirist. And he combines the painting style of Greek pots, Mimbres pottery, and comic book illustration to critique contemporary life, to critique Pueblo life. It's really a tremendous amount of fun.
Sounds like something that we absolutely have to see in order to to fully understand it. Very interesting. Let's turn to contemporary Native American jeweler Cody Sanderson. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you work mainly in silver, is that correct?
Yeah, primarily silver, but I do get into 18 karat gold, 22 karat gold. I also work in copper, aluminum, and very little stainless steel.
So how did you start being a jeweler, and how has your work been evolving?
I've been a jeweler for 8 years now. I've been in the art world for about 17. I started out as a salesman and kind of kept going with that.
And when I
was selling jewelry.
Okay.
And different types of art, pottery and paintings and things like that. But when the jewelry would come in, if I would see something, I would say, well, if I made this, I would do this to it. If I made this, I'd do that to it, you know. And then so I started doing it. I actually got into it and purchased a workbench and tools and more tools and metal and just start pounding and, you know, playing with it. And then worked with different shapes and worked with the plasticity of the metal, raising it, you know, doming it, and working with different shapes with it.
Did you apprentice with anybody?
Some people say they're self-taught. With me, you know, I read as much as I could. I asked a ton of questions from everyone, from fine jewelers here in town to, you know, fine jewelers who I could speak to, someone on the street who was selling the jewelry. Everyone was, you know, I was a student to all of them.
Now, your roots, your native roots are with multiple tribes, is that correct?
Yes, I'm Navajo, and that's where I grew up on the Navajo Reservation. I have family up here in Nambe and Hopi and Pima, but I'm registered with the Navajo tribe.
So to what extent are you working with traditional Navajo forms in your jewelry?
Not too many Navajo forms. But what I do is I use traditional methods and techniques, but I kind of bring a different twist to it. Something might be a little visually dangerous, but it really isn't, but it's made with traditional metalsmithing techniques that they were taught to by the Spanish.
It's interesting. I was looking at some of your work online, and there are some belt buckles there with pieces sticking out, like little, I don't know what you call them, points, and they look dangerous. Like,
yeah, they really are, and they're a lot of fun to work with, and I'm thinking the buckle that you're speaking of, There's a gentleman in Iowa, Des Moines, Iowa, who owns that buckle. He's 85 years old, loves it so much. He wears it almost every day, and he's getting another one. The one you saw was square. I'm making a round one for him, and he can't wait. So.
To what extent do your clients tell you what they want?
Well, that's what's really cool about what I'm doing. I pretty much make what I want, and it's favorable to, you know, a number of other people. The pieces that I make that look visually aggressive and, you know, like I wouldn't ever wear that, a majority of the people who are buying them are people, you know, comfortably into their 50s on up. And something you say, all right, some young kid would wear this in their 20s, 30s, some young professional. I think the older people who are purchasing these pieces have gotten to a point in their life where they don't care. They don't care what everybody else says about them, or they don't have to fit in a particular niche. And I have great-grandmothers wearing a multi-spike bracelet, and they think it's so great, and their grandkids love it because my grandma's cool, you know.
I noticed that some of your bracelets are decorated on the inside where no one's going to see it except the person wearing it.
Yeah, I do that with my rings, too. And the reason I do that, that could be something that, you know, you can keep to yourself or you can share with others. It's just a little added touch because, you know, you don't see it. No one will ever see it unless you show it to them. And that's kind of, you know, that's their own secret that they can keep for themselves.
You have a lot of freedom in the kind of artwork you do. You're working mostly with jewelry. Do you do other pieces as well that are not necessarily something that a person would wear?
Oh, yeah. I really like doing those things. Whether it's a tea infuser, I just made a lava lamp. And since I'm Navajo...
That's right. I saw that lava lamp. That's great.
I call it my Nava lava lamp. And I've done a Rubik's Cube, complete and total working Rubik's Cube with internal springs on it. And I'm hoping to do another one for the show here, which will be very dangerous looking.
Well, we look forward to seeing you at SOFA, Sculptural Objects and Functional Art, the fair that's coming up here in Santa Fe next week from the 8th through the 11th of July at the Santa Fe Convention Center. Let's turn to Peter Stessel. He's the director of the Blue Rain Gallery in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about the kind of work that you have in your gallery.
Well, briefly, Blue Rain Gallery was founded as a contemporary Native American art gallery about 18 years ago. We started up in Taos, and we moved to Santa Fe in 2004. And about 8 years ago, we started branching out and including some local regional artists, some non-Native artists. But at the SOFA West show coming up here, we will be featuring the work of Maria Zamora, and I think Cody's familiar with her work. She is a jeweler from Taos Pueblo, and another artist named Les Naminga, who I know Garth is familiar with, a ceramic artist who pushes the envelope in the Pueblo pottery world, we feel. I think all of the artists we're talking about, Garth's artists and Cody's work, it's all phenomenal, very innovative, unique work that I think people should really try to get out and look at. But back to Blue Rain Gallery, we also will feature some works by a glass artist from the Seattle area named Preston Singletary. He's a Tlingit native. He's one of our country's premier glass blowers, and he happens to be Tlingit. It's a kind of Alaska and Canadian tribe, and he currently has an exhibit at the Museum of Glass in Tacoma, Washington. We will also feature the work of Tammy Garcia, who is really known for her pottery, but about 10 years ago she branched out into bronze and also does a little... works with Preston and some other glass artists and does some glass pieces also. So those are some artists that we'll be featuring during the SOFA West show.
Glass is such a European form. How is it being used differently by Native people? Does it have a kind of Native feel to it when they're using it?
It does. Today we're seeing some new Native artists kind of... coming onto the glass scene, thanks a lot in part to what Preston has kind of paved the way for a lot of these artists. He's really a product of the studio glass movement out of Seattle that was developed in the late 60s by a popular artist named Dale Chihuly. But Preston was kind of in the right place at the right time and also very talented, and put his work to use and became a very well-known glass artist. And he has personally mentored some of these other artists from the area, guys like Ira Lujan and Marcus Spooner, and there's a few others that are coming up as native art. It's still kind of new medium for the native artists in glass, but when you look at their work, you can see a native or a Southwest connection to their work. That's kind of exciting.
Every year we talk about Indian Market and Spanish Market, and there's always the traditionalists and the people who are doing innovative art, and sometimes a tension between them. Do you see that?
Oh, yeah. The cliche, innovation is the enemy of tradition, that sort of thing goes on every day. I can tell you, I always speak for the collectors and who's buying things. They respond to new, innovative, quote, non-traditional work very well. But it has to be executed well. I personally feel like Diego Romero and Christine McCorris are phenomenal artists, and they've been successful because, yes, their art is beautiful, but they're, great technicians, and their execution is flawless. And if you combine those two, as many of our artists do, the collectors just eat it up. They want the new and different thing. I think a native artist has a great opportunity to express themselves, and you see bits of their native culture, but not always. It's often art by a person that happens to be Native American.
Is that your experience as well? People are looking, Garth Clark, for innovative work?
Some are. I think some of the collectors are very traditional. And for instance, with Christine, when Christine moved from doing more traditional forms about a decade ago and started to make these very evolved sculptural black pieces, there was a part of the market that just moved away from her because in their mind it wasn't native enough. But then others became more excited because they were looking for an edge in the native market. Although, to be honest, we sell more of her work to people who collect contemporary art rather than having any particular interest in Southwest art. And so it's interesting to see that, and it's, I think, also important. I know that the Indian market would like to expand out of the base of just the Indian art collectors. And with some of these artists, there's an opportunity to do that. Susan Falwell is another one who's taking native pottery into the contemporary mainstream. And it's exciting, but it is still a very, very small movement. Maybe 6, 8, 10 potters at most who are doing this.
So people will have a chance to experience all of this and more at SOFA, Sculptural Objects and Functional Art Fair, SOFA West, taking place here in Santa Fe. Have you been doing this before, Cody?
The SOFA show?
Yeah.
No, this will be my first time. Myself, Pat Pruitt, Kenneth Johnson, and a Robin Wainey. All of them are amazing at what they do. And we're going to be all together in a single booth under the Swaya umbrella, and it's going to be an adventure for us.
Now tell us just a little bit about these other artists and what kind of work they do.
Well, Pat Pruitt, he does a line of stainless steel jewelry. He inlays it with fine silver or high carat gold, either 24 or 22 carat. It's pretty amazing work. It takes 8,000 pounds to shape a bracelet, where myself or Kenneth or Robin, we can actually bend or open or close a bracelet, and Pat looks at us with a clenched fist and says, "Damn you, soft metals." Then Kenneth Johnson, who refers, he likes to do, no surface left untouched. It has to have some type of engraving, some faceted stone, and extremely beautiful work. He likes to work in, 18 karat or up. And Robin Wainey, she's kind of new to the jewelry realm, but, she's really, really someone you need to really watch out for.
Well, Cody Sanderson, Garth Clark, and Peter Stessel, thank you so much for being with us, and we will see you next week at the Santa Fe Convention Center. For more information, people can go to sofaexpo.com on the web, and we'll see you there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Tenzing Sonam. He is the co-director and writer of the film The Sun Behind the Clouds, Tibet's Struggle for Freedom, which is opening on Saturday the 3rd of July at the CCA. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a documentary about the state of Tibet and Tibetans 50 years after the violent takeover by the Chinese and the Dalai Lama's exile to India and lots of people's exile. Tell us about the protests that erupted in the year 2008. What happened?
Well, the protests that took place in 2008 started on the 49th anniversary of the fall of Lhasa. Tibetans commemorate 10th March 1959 as the date when Tibet actually fell. Because that was the date when the Dalai Lama kind of was under siege in Lhasa and then subsequently escaped to India. So this is a very significant date because the monks in Lhasa who demonstrated first chose that date to make a statement, which was that 49 years after, you know, China had taken over Tibet, they still had not forgotten that actually Tibet is a free country and chose that date to, raise their protest. Now, this came as a complete surprise to most of us. I think to the Chinese officials, certainly, but even to those of us who live in exile, because for decades, the Chinese have suppressed Tibet so severely that, the biggest demonstration you could expect in Lhasa was like literally two or three people, raising a slogan and then being immediately arrested and bundled off to prison. So suddenly to see these demonstrations in Lhasa taking place at that time, came as a big surprise to us. And what surprised us even more was that it spread all across the Tibetan plateau. So within days, the protests had spread thousands of kilometers away from Lhasa. And this was definitely the biggest uprising in Tibet since 1959.
And the protesters were people from all walks of life.
That's correct. It initially started with monks in Lhasa, but very soon, like literally within days, the protests had spread to, ordinary people. So there were students, farmers, business people, even people who work in the Chinese government were all involved in these protests. So it was the first time that we saw such a wide kind of spread of people participating in these protests.
It's interesting, as you point out in the film, that most of the protesters were born under occupied Tibet. They'd never even lived in the same country with the Dalai Lama, even while they considered him their leader. That's really quite something.
Well, I think that's, all Tibetans are basically very, very religious. I mean, Buddhism is very much a part and parcel of Tibetan life. And the fact that the Dalai Lama, who is revered by Tibetans as a spiritual leader and a political leader, of course, but more than that, the Dalai Lama kind of symbolizes Tibet because he's considered to be the reincarnation of the patron deity of Tibet, the Buddha of compassion. So for Tibetans, the Dalai Lama has a very special significance. And the fact that he has been in exile all these years has, I think, only strengthened their bond towards him, their feeling of devotion and loyalty to him. And that has never died, despite the fact that China, of course, over the decades, has tried everything to destroy this connection. As we point out in the film, and as you perhaps know, the Chinese have constantly demonized the Dalai Lama in Tibet and in China, calling him names. I mean, just recently they called him a monk in wolf's, clothes. Or something like that, So they're constantly trying to demonize him. But I think that's just had the effect of redoubling the faith of the Tibetan people in the Dalai Lama.
Now, the Dalai Lama, since 1959, had been calling for Tibetan independence. But in the late 1980s, he revised that and began to call for a so-called middle way approach. What was the middle way?
See, I think by the 80s, the Dalai Lama felt that there was this impasse in terms of trying to make any breakthrough with the Chinese government in resolving the Tibet issue. So he decided to take the kind of supreme step, the supreme sacrifice, and give up independence, saying that, let's let history be like behind us. Let's not look to the past. Let's look to the future. And in the future, let's set out a scenario where we can live with the Chinese, be under the People's Republic of China, and in return, all we're asking for is greater autonomy, genuine autonomy, as he calls it, to look after our own culture, our religion, our language, to protect that. And that was the essence of his middle way approach, which was basically giving up independence in return for genuine autonomy. But of course, since the late 80s, he has repeatedly tried to engage with the Chinese. The Chinese have talked to some of his representatives, but the upshot of it has been that China has consistently rejected his middle way approach, has basically accused the Dalai Lama of seeking independence secretly under the disguise of middle way, and has basically said that the Dalai Lama actually doesn't represent the Tibetan people. He has no right to speak on behalf of the Tibetan people, and all the Chinese are willing to talk to him about. And that even that's if he changes his opinion and revises his bad behavior, is to discuss his return to Tibet. I mean, that is the only concession the Chinese are willing to make. So I guess part of the making of this film was really to examine where we were at 50 years after the fall of Tibet, but also more than 20 years after the Dalai Lama set out his middle way approach, because we have reached an impasse at this point.
Now, the middle way approach is deeply embedded in Tibetan Buddhism and this whole concept of interdependence, as you talk
Correct.
About in the film. Yeah.
Yeah, because, the Dalai Lama is coming from a very Buddhist perspective. I mean, everything he does in life is imbued by his practice of Buddhism. And in Buddhism, the middle way is, a very important concept, because it says that everything you do in life, you should avoid extreme positions and always find the middle ground. And I suppose that's what he intended to, do when he set out his political policy of the middle way. But of course, unfortunately, China doesn't share the same ideals as he does, and so feels no compulsion to, to respond.
Now, what do the Chinese want in Tibet? What do you think is their main strategic goal in being there?
Well, I mean, one of the first things that Mao Zedong announced after the communists took control of China in 1949 was he announced the liberation of Tibet. And part of this, I think, stems from a very deep-rooted kind of Chinese sense of nationalism, which, believes that the empire, the great Chinese empire, should be restored to its former glory. After, the period of colonialism in the late 19th century, when China felt deeply humiliated by Western powers, taking control of China. So I think this attempt to, in their words, liberate Tibet and reconcile it to the motherland was an expression of this deep sense of insecurity that they felt about, restoring their pride. And that was the initial impulse. But of course, the fact is that Tibet is a vast country. I mean, the whole Tibetan plateau, as we mentioned in the film, is about the size of Western Europe. And, with a population of about 6 million, it's like really sparsely populated. So besides that, it's got huge mineral wealth that's never been exploited, but has been since the Chinese have come to Tibet. It's strategically placed in the heart of Central Asia, giving the Chinese like a military kind of a very strategic military position. And the rivers of Asia all start in Tibet. And as we all know, water is going to become a big issue in this coming century. So in all these aspects, China has much to gain by hanging on to Tibet and really nothing to lose by giving it up.
We're talking to Tenzing Sonam about the film The Sun Behind the Clouds, Tibet's Struggle for Freedom. Why, I mean, I can understand, all the things that you've said about the expansion of empire and the quest for natural resources and for water. Why does that, in the Chinese government's mind, require the destruction of Tibetan culture and the suppression of religious freedom?
See, what the Chinese lack in Tibet is legitimacy, because even though it kind of constantly tells the world and its own people that Tibet was always a part of China and, hence China has every right to be in Tibet, the fact remains that China invaded Tibet in 1950. It came to Tibet with an army. It defeated the Tibetan army, and it forced the Tibetan government to come to terms. So there is this issue of legitimacy, which always, you know, sits uneasily with the Chinese leadership, because they know that at any point this could become a major issue, because, in fact, Tibet was never a part of China. I mean, if it was, why did the Chinese have to, you know, invade it? So I think this lack of legitimacy creates great insecurity for the Chinese government, and therefore they feel that they have to suppress any kind of sense of Tibetan national identity, you know, kind of crush it completely, because otherwise there's always a chance that Tibetans are going to rise up. And this was proven by the demonstrations in 2008, when, you know, 49 years after Chinese kind of occupation, Tibetans in Tibet were still rising up and shouting for independence. So I think that's something that really scares the Chinese. And this is another reason why they don't want to have the Dalai Lama come back to Tibet, because they know that the risk they face in dealing with the Dalai Lama and having him come back to Tibet is just too great, because, you know, his return might trigger all kinds of things inside Tibet that might then lead to great unrest. So for them, it's easier to just play the waiting game and, you know, wait for him to die and hope that everything's going to be resolved after that.
One of the things I found fascinating about the film was that the anti-Tibet rhetoric that we hear from Chinese people is just textbook Marxist communism about the evils of serfdom and some kind of medieval agrarian system. What do ordinary Chinese people actually know about Tibet? Where do they get their information?
No, I think this kind of, you know, extreme, as you put it, Marxist rhetoric when it comes to Tibet is really aimed at the Chinese people themselves. Because as I was saying earlier, this lack of legitimacy that the Chinese have, you know, in their rule over Tibet means that they have to somehow convince their own people that, you know, their presence in Tibet is justified. And one of the ways they do that is by presenting Tibet as this, you know, medieval hell on earth that they liberated and then brought, you know, civilization and enlightenment to. But of course, you know, if we look at history, this is like classic kind of colonial justification. I mean, you know, colonialists everywhere justified their presence in the countries they ruled and occupied by claiming that these countries were backward and barbaric and, you know, hence they needed their presence. And the Chinese are doing exactly that in Tibet. Now, the ordinary Chinese have been fed this lie since they were literally like, you know, kids from the time they were in school. And they believe in this. They believe, you know, and what's amazing, as we saw in 2008 when all the Chinese students came out to demonstrate in support of the Olympic torch relay and against all the pro-Tibet, you know, demonstrations that were taking place around the world, especially in America, what was really amazing was that these Chinese students who had lived in America for, you know, a number of years, had access to information, were often critical of their own government when it came to things like internet censorship and, you know, lack of freedom of speech, were only too willing to repeat their government's line on Tibet with no question at all. I mean, as you saw in the film, they were literally reading out handouts from the Chinese embassy that was, you know, written in this kind of language without questioning it at all. So that is really amazing. I mean, it just shows how deep-rooted this, you know, kind of brainwashing of the Chinese people has been.
There was a striking moment in the film in which one of the people interviewed said that Tibet was quickly reaching a point of no return, in which, because there's so many Chinese migrants who have come in and they've settled and then they have children and just there's generations of Chinese people there. And at basically, there will come a point where Tibet has been changed so completely that there's no going back. Kind of like, I mean, here I am sitting in New Mexico on Indian land, but, you know, it's not going to happen, probably, or it won't happen, that all of us migrants who've been here for decades or centuries are going to leave. Is Tibet at that point already?
It's certainly at a very critical stage at this point. I mean, I don't think we are yet at the point of no return. I think that's why it's so important for the world to, you know, wake up to what's happening in Tibet and to really lend us like a genuine support instead of this kind of lip service that we've been having all these years. I mean, there is genuine sympathy for Tibet, but that sympathy in the world doesn't translate into any kind of serious action. And I think that's what's needed at this point, because if China is left unchallenged in what's happening in Tibet, there is no doubt that in another generation or two, Tibetans will become minorities in Tibet, because anyone who's been to, say, Lhasa knows, can see already, you know, that Tibetans are in a minority in Lhasa. And, you know, that same kind of demographic change is taking place all over the country. So definitely, I think a time will come when it may be too late for Tibetans to reclaim their country. But I personally, I don't believe we've reached that point at this stage. I think there is still hope for Tibet. And I think, you know, what we need to do is to once again alert the world as to what's happening in Tibet.
There's massive public opinion in favor of Tibet and the plight of both Tibetans in Tibet and in exile among those who know of the abuses that are going on. But what about governments? Are there any national governments that are willing to stand up for Tibet?
Unfortunately, not. I mean, there's great sympathy among many Western governments, including the United States, for the Dalai Lama and for his middle way approach. But sadly, it seems that, you know, because the Dalai Lama's middle way approach is a pacifist, position, and it's to do with dialogue and, negotiations, it suits the Western government's, line, because they don't want to have to take tough stands where China's concerned. So as long as there seems to be some kind of a pretense of dialogue going on, they're happy to leave it at that. And that's really the problem that we're facing, because the Western governments, including the U.S., needs to understand that, you know, China needs serious pressure. You know, I mean, we need to put serious pressure on China. Unfortunately, at this point, because China is so powerful, as you know, we all know, no Western government seems willing to want to take it on, and that's really damaging for Tibet.
Within the Tibetan exile community, there seems to be a conflict, as is shown in this film, between those who follow the Dalai Lama's middle way and those who really are still seeking an independent Tibet. How is that playing out?
Yeah, basically, 90, I would say about, almost 100% of Tibetans believe that Tibet, was an independent country, and given the choice, would want it to be independent again. But what changed was when the Dalai Lama presented his middle way approach in the 80s, people basically followed that or accepted that and supported it, because it came from the Dalai Lama. It seemed a reasonable proposal that he was making, that in order to break the deadlock with China, we had to make a compromise, and that compromise would lead to some resolution of the situation. So most Tibetans supported the middle way approach, even though in their hearts they all still believed in independence. What's happened now, I think, or what's happening now, is that 20 years have passed since the Dalai Lama presented his middle way approach. Numerous discussions have happened with the Chinese, and they've all ended in the same result, which is total rejection by China. And I think people are now beginning to realize that China is actually not serious about negotiating with the Dalai Lama. It's not interested in this in his middle way approach at all. What it's doing is it's just buying time and waiting for him to pass away. Now, this realization is creating a lot of frustration among Tibetans, because Tibetans want the Dalai Lama's middle way to succeed, but at the same time recognize that if it doesn't succeed in his lifetime, there could be all kinds of problems after that. And I think that is where a lot of Tibetans, especially younger Tibetans, feel that we need to take a tougher line on China. We need to go back to the goal of independence, because what have we got to lose? And I mean, I should mention here that although there is this division emerging in the Tibetan community, everyone is united in the sense that we all believe that the movement should remain nonviolent. Whether it's the middle way approach or whether it's a fight for independence, it should remain a nonviolent struggle. I think all Tibetans are unified in that thinking. But that is really where the divisions beginning to emerge.
We're talking about the film The Sun Behind the Clouds, Tibet's Struggle for Freedom. So in this film, we witness a very interesting phenomenon, which is a march in 2008 from Dharamsala, India, to Tibet. How did this idea to do a big protest march come into being?
Well, as I was saying earlier, you know, there is a lot of frustration now among the Tibetan community, especially in exile, because people feel that there's no movement in the political progress, and yet there's nothing that they as ordinary citizens can do to kind of help the Tibet movement. So in 2008, recognizing that the 50th anniversary of 1959 was coming up, that it was the year of the Beijing Olympics, so the international spotlight would be trained on Beijing, a number of Tibetan NGOs in exile decided to come together and organize this peaceful march to Tibet. The idea was that by marching to Tibet, you know, they would highlight the plight of Tibet again and, you know, throw it into focus in the year when China would be in the spotlight. So that was really the kind of the basis for beginning this march. Of course, the Dalai Lama himself was very much against this march because he felt, A, it wouldn't achieve its objectives, and B, you know, it would cause embarrassment to the Indian government, put them in a spot because China would be unhappy with it. So he tried to get the marchers to stop. You know, on two occasions, he actually called the organizers and asked them to stop. But in a rare kind of show of defiance almost, they didn't listen to him and they continued marching.
It's odd and sort of interesting for us in the West who are not Tibetans to watch militant monks. It seems to be kind of almost a contradiction between the peaceful Buddhist philosophy and direct action that contains anger and nationalism, though it's obviously still nonviolent.
Correct. In fact, I think in the West we have this almost misleading impression of, you know, not just Tibetan monks, but of all Tibetans being kind of, you know, peaceful, compassionate, you know, Buddhist, almost like otherworldly creatures. And in a sense, I think that's actually done us a lot of harm because people don't realize that Tibetans are just like anybody else, you know, and what we are struggling for, what our cause is a political cause that's no different from any other political cause. And, you know, by not seeing us as, you know, as real people, I think we kind of sometimes people tend to overlook that aspect of our struggle. And monks, you know, have always been in the forefront of Tibetan kind of struggles and movements. Even in 1959, you know, before 1959, there was a guerrilla movement, an armed uprising against the Chinese, you know, forces that occupied Tibet. And a lot of these people who took up arms at that time were monks who gave up their vows, you know, returned their monks' vows, became lay people to fight the Chinese because they saw that as the enemy that was destroying the Tibetan way of life and Tibetan Buddhism. So monks have always been in the forefront of our political struggles, and you know, within the Tibetan community, that's really not unusual.
The Indian police, I mean, you're watching this film and you expect a confrontation between the, and I don't want to give away the whole film, but you expect a confrontation between the Tibetans and the Chinese on the border, but before they get there, they're arrested a couple of times by Indian police. Why, what interest did the Indian police have in stopping this march?
Well, you see, India is in a very, very delicate position when it comes to Tibet. Because although the Indian government officially recognizes that Tibet is a part of China, it still harbors the Dalai Lama and harbors his government in exile in Dharamsala, although it doesn't officially accept its existence. But the fact remains that the Dalai Lama and his government in exile are allowed, you know, to operate out of India. So, and China is, of course, very much aware of that. On top of that, India and China now have this huge long border that has been, you know, the point of contention. There's been dispute over this border. There's even been a war fought over this border. So India is always, like, you know, being threatened by this Chinese presence along its border. So it has to be very careful in how it deals with China. And I think this march, if they had allowed the march to go right up to the border, would have been taken as a sign of provocation by the Chinese. And then, you know, that could have caused a major diplomatic and perhaps even a military kind of row. So obviously, India was very clear that it didn't want it to escalate to that point. So I think right from the beginning, it was clear that they were not going to let the marchers, you know, get anywhere near the border. And of course, the fact that the Dalai Lama was also supporting the Indian government's position gave them even greater kind of strength to stop the march when they did.
Where have you shown the film? How is it being received?
The film has now shown in several film festivals around the world, and the response has really been quite amazing to us. For instance, it won the Václav Havel Award in Prague at the One World Film Festival, and President Havel gave us the award himself and, you know, read out a little commentary on why he selected our film. And, you know, Václav Havel is an old friend of the Dalai Lama. He's an old supporter of Tibet. But he said that this film, for the first time, allowed him to understand the true feelings of the Tibetan people. So, I mean, I think what we've discovered with numerous question and answer sessions that we've had across America, in England, in you know, in the Czech Republic, in India, is that people are somehow, they feel like they've been enlightened about the true nature of the Tibetan struggle. And I think that's something that we did set out to achieve. So, you know, we're very, very happy with that response.
Is there any way to show this to the Chinese public through YouTube or other means like that?
Well, we are making a Chinese language version of the film. We're also making a Tibetan language version of the film. Of course, officially, there's no way this film can, you know, be shown in China or in Tibet. But there are unofficial channels, usually, you know, kind of sort of taken by video pirates in India, who pirate all these films and then find a way of smuggling them into Tibet. So that's our hope. We hope that, you know, the film will find an audience in Tibet and China through the underground network.
Tenzin, what is your own story? You were born and raised in Dharamsala?
No, I was born and raised in Darjeeling, which is a town in northeastern India, which very close to the Tibetan border, and a town that had a long history of you know, connection with Tibet. My parents were refugees who came to India from Tibet, along with you know, more than 100,000 Tibetans after the Chinese occupation. And I was born and brought up in India, in the Tibetan exile community.
What is your hope? I mean, given the, as you characterize it in the film, the kind of David and Goliath struggle between Tibet and China, and one having all the power and all the firepower, and the other not, what are your realistic hopes, or your hopes, realistic or not, for Tibet?
Well, as a Tibetan, and any Tibetan will tell you this, you know, we have hope because we believe our struggle is just. And, you know, we cannot give up hope because our future, you know, the future of our country, our entire culture depends on us having this hope that things are going to change. One of the things that really revitalized the struggle for Tibetans was the uprising of 2008, because that was really a reminder to us that people in Tibet, despite being under such harsh kind of suppression, you know, despite knowing that the consequences of rising up and standing up would be, you know, torture, imprisonment, death even, despite that, so many thousands of them stood up and, you know, shouted for their rights. So that really gave us renewed courage and renewed hope that, you know, our struggle was still alive, that it was going to continue. And I think right now, I think what we really need to focus on is really getting genuine international support behind the Tibetan struggle. I mean, we've had a lot of sympathy for Tibet, but a lot of that sympathy, as I was saying earlier, kind of stems from a sort of almost a misconception of what the Tibetan issue is about. I mean, there are thousands of Americans who have, you know, interest in Tibetan Buddhism, who have become Tibetan Buddhists, who practice Tibetan Buddhism. Yet, if you ask the majority of them, do you support Tibet politically, they would probably say no. And, you know, I mean, it's like this, like when the Dalai Lama comes to, say, New York and he gives a talk in Central Park, you know, you have like 60,000 people coming out to hear him talk. But when you have a demonstration outside the Chinese embassy in New York, you'll be lucky if you have 500 people come. Now, why is this? Why is there so much interest in, you know, the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism, and yet that interest and support doesn't translate into political support for us? I think that's where, you know, we need to really change the way people see the Tibet issue and change the nature of the support that they give us.
Tenzin Sonam is writer and co-director of the film The Sun Behind the Clouds, Tibet's Struggle for Freedom, and it's opening at the CCA here in Santa Fe on Saturday, the 3rd of July, and we look forward to seeing you here in Santa Fe.
Thank you very much. We look forward to being there as well.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, The Four Freshmen. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow.